Ali Reza Gulavjan is a unique addition to the national and international film industry.
Ali is one of the greatest directors I've ever worked with.
Der unheimlich viel zulässt, aber auch genau weiß, was will.
We are very honored to have the winner of the Bavarian Film Prize, writer and director of 2019's The Goldfish, Alireza Golefshan. Hey, Ali, thanks for being on the show, man.
Hi, thanks.
Is it okay if I call you Ali?
Yeah, this is what everyone calls me. So
is that like the standard thing?
Yeah, it's a bit easier than Ali Reza.
Ali Reza.
Most people, yeah. But Ali's fine.
Yeah. I've been practicing. I wanted, like, in case you were someone who really wanted to be called properly by the name, I was practicing Ali Reza Golefshan.
Oh, wow.
Is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Like butter, baby. Mo, take notes.
Yeah, you can call me Ali Reza Golefshan every time in this
Ali Reza Golefshan.
If you like
I have a very important question for you, Ali Reza Golefshan. No, we're really happy to have you on the show, man. And this is actually our first time to meet you. And I thought actually we could kick off like dedicating this episode to someone who I know is listening, a good friend of ours, Moritz Binder. So hi, Moritz.
Hi, Moritz. Hi.
Something that we actually wanted to dive in first about with you, if that's okay with you, would actually be a bit about the era that you were born in Iran, because mm-hmm. I think that's a super interesting topic. Mm-hmm. And just to see, like, you know, what your feelings or opinions are about it.
Artsy fartsy history.
So when Ali was born in 1986, the Iran-Iraq war was still going strong. Iraq was dropping airstrikes and Scud missiles from Russia in Iran, decimating cities like his hometown Tehran and killing thousands. Ali was born after the Iranian Revolution of 1979, which culminated in the overthrow of Iran's last monarch. The whole government had shifted just as they entered the 80s, and an Islamic Republic was put in place under the Grand Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, who was supported by the US. 3 years after Ali's birth, Ruhollah Khomeini died and was succeeded by Ali Khamenei. This guy had a lot of power. He was considered the most powerful political authority in the country. There were major protests during his reign, during the 1994 Kazvin protests, the 1999 Iranian student protests, the 2009 presidential election protests, and general protests and strikes from 2011 to as recent as 2019. Around the time Ali and his family moved to Germany, Mohammad Khatami was president of Iran. He ran on a platform of liberalization and reform, earning 70% of the vote. He often clashed with conservative Islamists. However, the economy was relatively healthy during that time. Debt was cut tremendously, the lowest since the Iran-Iraq ceasefire. The poverty line was down, and he even helped reduce the fall of the Iranian currency. We know that Iran and the US have had an interesting relationship over the years. From the US supporting Iran in the early 80s, then sympathizing with Iraq during the war by offering diplomatic, monetary, and military support amongst many other things, not to mention the Iran-Contra affair and, maybe even more importantly, current events like Donald Trump drawing back from the Iran nuclear deal and the tension there after the death of Soleimani in Iraq. For the first time ever in history, a US president, this time being Donald Trump, declared a powerful arm of the Iranian military, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, a foreign terrorist group. In response, Iran declared the U.S. a state sponsor of terrorism and called Washington's forces in the region terrorist groups. You're born in 86, right?
That's true, yeah.
In Iran. So in Tehran?
Yes, in the capital, in Tehran, yes.
So this is
right smack dab in the middle of the Iran-Iraq war, right?
Yeah, it was like the last 2 years.
The last 2 years.
Yeah, okay. it went till 1988. And like I was 2 years old when the war was over, so I don't remember.
Don't remember too much about it.
I don't remember too much, but I know that my father had built like some sort of shelter in the apartment in case of bombing. So
it's, really?
Yeah, it stayed there after the war, and it was like just, you know, a place for me to play with my sister.
Man, that's crazy.
So that's what I remember from the war.
Yeah, I was gonna ask, because I mean, this is like, during this time, I think Iraq was like bombing the shit out of Tehran, right?
Yeah.
With these Russian Scud missiles,
yeah.
And like killing. I didn't know, you know, how your parents were reacting to this, or so they was everyday life still normal for them? Was it still possible somehow?
Or no.
Did they have crazy stories?
I think especially the last year was kind of horrible for people in Tehran, and we moved to a village up north, near the Caspian Sea.
Oh, okay.
For a year or so. I don't remember that either, but they didn't want to take the risk to stay in Tehran with the bombings and everything going on. So I actually lived my second year of my life in a very, very small village with cows and cattle and everything. But
really?
I don't remember a thing, to be honest. No.
Oh, that's actually really...
I went there visiting, like, you know, when I was 8 or 9 years later, years old, but... yeah, they didn't stay in Tehran, but it was my sisters can still remember because they're older and they don't recall those memories that you know, easily or frequently.
How many siblings do you have actually?
Four sisters.
Four sisters.
Yes,
are you the youngest? Or?
No, I actually have one sister who is 1 year younger than me, and three sisters who are a bit older.
Oh my God! Yeah. Your poor dad.
It's the best thing that could happen to me. I can.
Man, you know, that I think that's something I hear a lot actually from people when they have a lot of siblings, especially if they're all of the opposite gender.
Mm-hmm.
It's something really nice to balance out and like learn from. And
yeah.
I don't know, I like the idea of having like a team of sisters.
True, a lot of attention.
You got a lot of attention when you were young?
Yeah. The only boy in the family, and you know, there were. And
oh,
I had basically four mothers with my three older sisters, and you know, wasn't that bad.
Would you, just to stay on this topic a little longer,
yeah.
Would you say that, like, did the aftermath of the war affect your youth too much? Or since you had moved to this village, was it just like a normal life kind of?
No, I mean, the life, as I remember it was, to me, because I didn't know anything else, another life was kind of normal. So it wasn't affected by, like... danger or anything like that. But of course the regime had changed, you know, the Iranian regime after the war, because they used it for propaganda purposes, and the war was like all over the place and still is.
Yeah.
So the war started like 1 year after the Iranian or Islamic Revolution in 79.
I was going to ask about that next. Yeah.
And actually, I think it was, as far as I know, like the purpose of that war from the Western point of view was to destabilized the new forming Iranian Islamic regime.
And that's, yeah.
It didn't go that well. It actually had opposite effects.
Right.
So the war was like uniting the whole nation. And during those 8 years, they, you know, kind of got rid of every form of opposition that was forming as political parties and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So after those 8 years... you know, they kept up the spirit of a war, of being in war with the Western world, and they still do. And they they keep up the image of martyrs and, you know, soldiers who had fallen during those 8 years very high. And, you know, their paintings are all over the place in Tehran and across the country. So in terms of propaganda and how they use the war to tell us story of this Islamic regime, how they sustained and withstood the you know oppression from the West or attacks from the West.
Mm-hmm.
It was very present during my youth in Iran.
Was that connected to the death of, is it Khomeini? And the rise of Khomeini.
They're very similar names.
They're similar, yeah, and I didn't want to.
No. Khomeini was the first guy, and Khomeini is the second supreme leader who's still there.
Because I mean, I know there was an insane amount. I mean, there's still protests about him. I mean, these protests were crazy. There was the 1994, is it Qazvin protests?
Mm-hmm.
And then the 1999 Iranian student protest, 2009, 2011, 12 Iranian protest, and then 2017, 18, 18, 19 general protests and strikes. I mean, you must still have some family in Iran, right? I mean, how did they feel about his rule, and were they involved with these protests or?
Different. I mean, I have like, you know, young cousins who are studying in Tehran, and I have also relatives who are kind of religious and are backing the Islamic regime, and people who are just trying to do their business and trying not to mind anything, you know. So there are all sorts of reactions within my family in Iran. So
some are more like, so it's even like, it's like politics anywhere. There's people who are really involved in it and maybe
I know,
fueled by it somehow, and then others who want to take a step back.
Yeah, actually, I know a lot of people who try to step back, because especially, you know, people who are above 40 or 50 and who lived experienced the first revolution and who are kind of, you know, they don't believe in revolutions anymore. They're just trying to lead a decent life and not being bothered or not bother anyone, and that's what they try. And they're not that political. And I have a lot of, you know, those types in my family, I guess. Yeah, but also I think younger people are more into politics, which is a good thing.
I think it's kind of always the case, right? Yeah. Somewhere between like 17 and 25.
Yeah.
There's usually like a fuel within that people to,
and also, you know, people who can afford a good living are, you know, they're trying to mind their business, and people who are, you know, having a hard time finding jobs or food are, you know, getting more and more political to try and change something, you know. But
yeah,
I'm not that into you know, the local politics, to be honest. So
okay.
Because I moved to Germany when I was 12 years old.
Yeah, that's
I try to keep up with news, and, you know, when I talk to my relatives in Iran, to try to ask them what's going on. But it's really hard to really understand the feeling, how it feels when you live there. You know, it's a different thing.
I can really connect to that because, well, and it's funny because it's also different. But, you know, I'm living here too, and you know, as much as I. Because I'm also not very political. I've never been someone who's searching constantly for, you know, new policies or what's being changed or what may be, you know, changing around me. But I am looking into that now more in Germany as I'm getting older and stuff. But what's funny is I can't really escape the news in America, even if I wanted to. It's funny, like it's so prominent in popular news everywhere I go. So
yeah, of course.
Trump, I feel like, is everywhere. Trump is everywhere, unfortunately. And I feel like I see that everywhere, and I feel like I am really even more so up to date with American politics than German, even if I don't want to be, even sometimes I don't care. But yeah, it's hard to know exactly how my friends or my family might feel being there as compared to what I'm reading here from.
Yeah.
You know.
And it also kind of makes you feel depressed because you can't do anything about it, really. That's
how I felt,
you know, in the last couple of weeks or months, you know, all the news about Iran and everything that was going on, you know, it was constantly in my news feed, and it made me feel like, okay, what do you call it in German? You say ohnmächtig, like, you know, out of power, and, you know,
yeah, like helpless, like
helpless and powerless, yeah.
Absolutely.
And yeah.
Well, I'm curious also, like, you moved in 98, is that right?
98.
And so interesting to me is the culture of Iran right around that time, because, you know, again, I'm just referencing some research here.
Yeah.
Like, right around the time that you guys moved, Mohammad Khatami was president, and then, you know, he ran on this platform of liberalization and reform. He won like 70% of the vote. And then, you know, it's just interesting, like the economy was looking good. Debt was cut down the lowest since the ceasefire, and the poverty line was down. So, you know, on paper, it looks like things were getting more promising for Iran, and things were looking better for the people. So I'm curious, why at that time particularly was it your parents' choice to move to Germany, and why Germany?
To be honest, our immigration to Germany wasn't really political, and
that's what I was really curious about. If it was escaping something, or if it was just a wholly different reason.
No, we had a connection to Germany because my father had studied here in the 70s, and he studied mechanical engineering in Hamburg, and then he went back to Iran and worked there. But he did a lot of business with Germany, especially in Hamburg. And, when I was a kid, we traveled a couple of times to Germany. So I've been here like as a tourist or something.
Ah, okay. Yeah. Oh, I didn't know that.
So we were, but we hadn't really had the chance to move because, a family with 7 members, it's really, it's not that easy to move from one country to another. But in 1998, we had that chance because my older sister had married someone who lived in Germany. Mm-hmm. So she was the first to move to Germany, and then we had the opportunity to come here. But to be honest, we didn't, at least I didn't know. I don't know if my parents knew. They kind of must have known something, but they told me, pack your things for a month or 2 months or something. We're going to visit your sister, and we're going to be back in Tehran for fall when school begins.
Did you feel like this was just another tourist visit, and then all of a sudden you couldn't go back?
Yeah, yeah.
And, oh, shit. That must have been devastating if you thought you're going back to your friends.
Yeah, actually, they gave me a list for souvenirs. They all wanted to have football jerseys and original ones because you couldn't get the original jerseys in Iran. And I made a list for that guy. He wants a Brazilian jersey and this. But they never got their souvenirs. But it didn't feel that terrible. I guess for them, maybe, because they're still waiting for this.
Where's Ali?
I don't know. But it was okay for me because we moved with all my sisters were here.
It's
my
been
parents
20
were here.
Years. Where is he?
Yeah, I sometimes think back to it because, I was like 12 years old, and that's the age when friendship becomes more important. And
oh,
it's
my
just
God.
Not,
that we have a whole thing. I am dying to get in with you about your early years in Germany. Yeah. But just before we settle into Germany full time for the rest, I do have one more thing about Iran I wanted to talk about. Mm-hmm. And you just let us know whenever that gets too much for you.
No problem. Yeah, Khatami, by the way, was like our Obama back then, he was like,
really?
Change you can't believe in. And what after Obama came,
I love that. Speaking of, US presidents, the last thing was, I thought it was really important to address the fact that, you're from Iran and I'm from the US, and there's obviously this ridiculous history between the US and Iran. And I wanted to know, we've touched on it a little bit already, but I just wanted to know your opinion on it, or if it's something that, like you said earlier, mm-hmm. is something you kind of push out of daily life. Because I also, it's so much information every day now, but mm-hmm. just briefing over, because this is really crazy, this interesting relationship. We had the U.S. Supporting Iran in the early 80s, but then sympathizing with Iraq during the war by offering diplomatic, monetary, military support, amongst a myriad of other things. Not to mention the Iran-Contra affair, and then maybe more importantly, current events like Trump drawing back from the nuclear deal and the tension there after the death of Soleimani in Iraq. And then he calls, he calls the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps a foreign terrorist group. And that's a lot of information to take in. And even if you're reading it on the news in a week, it's a lot to take in. But just because it's interesting between Iran and the U.S., what's your feeling about that sort of relationship between those countries, or is it too much to take in and it can't affect your daily life that much?
It does. I mean, it depends how much, how present it is in the news at the time, we were talking about. But it actually did affect my daily life, when after New Year, like third of January, I think the whole new thing started. After
the whole threat of World War III or whatever, after New Year.
Yeah, yeah. It was like so we had two good days and then
that's it.
2020 started all right, but on the third day it was like, okay, maybe next year. But yeah, Soleimani's death was like yeah, it was a tense moment in history. I mean,
yeah.
But the good thing is, I think we can say now, like after weeks after that incident, that no one wanted to go into war, and I think that's a good news, you know, because I don't think that Iran and the United States are interested in direct confrontation, and that's what I learned from it, and it does. You know, concern me a little less in my everyday life since then.
Do you have a theory as to why Donald Trump would push this kind of behavior into the forefront? Like why he would leave the deal, make these big claims? Do you think it's something to do with his own? It's his own political interest. But.
I guess I don't know. I'm not that, you know, too much into politics, but his passion are deals and making deals. I mean, the art of the deal was called. I think is the title of his book, and I think he's not really satisfied.
Book
with
quotation marks.
Book, yeah, with quotation marks. I haven't read it, but most people haven't. Probably not even himself. But you know, I think he's kind of, you know, from a businessman point of view that he still has somehow. I think he wasn't really satisfied with the deal in a way of
right.
You know, monetary values that was, you know, transferred, and still keeps talking about the sums that the U.S. transferred to Iran. And I think he at the end of the day. You know, it's a little, you know, puts my mind a little bit at ease that I think he's not really interested in war, but just to make a better deal. And that's
right. Even if there's not a better deal to be made for,
yeah.
or for any reason,
yeah.
just like to, like, I was the one who made the better
yeah.
situation. Okay. I
mean,
was just curious about
do
that.
You have this board game called Risk? Do you play that?
I played Risk.
Yeah. And, you know, there was a time when I played it a lot with my friends, and I think that's the best game to understand global politics, because you come at some point you come to, you know, in a situation where you can't have both. You know, you have to decide to either to keep that friendship or attack that side. You know, it's kind of and, you know, with time as I grow older, I try to see politics more in a, you know, distant and mature, and, you know, it's just for them, it's a game, you know, everyone's interested in their, you know, interests. And
that's what it boils down to, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. And they try to make the best out of it, to, you know, and yeah.
And a lot of it just comes down to money sometimes.
Of course, yeah.
As with all things.
But, you know, the U.S. and Iran political history is long, and I think they always wanted to have...
You can have a whole podcast just about that history, actually.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
really it's, insane.
They wanted to have control in this region, and it was possible with Shah, you know, before the revolution, and after the revolution, they were afraid that they were losing control of the region, and they're still struggling to regain that control. And Iran has been very stable despite the attacks from the Western world since the revolution, and I think that's, you know, it's a we'll see. How it turns out, and I hope
fingers
that,
crossed.
Yeah, I hope that the oil is running out soon.
Me too. At least when the world burns down, we'll have made this podcast, and then we can have a beer and laugh at them.
Yeah.
But this is actually a perfect transition. I just wanted to get all those. Now we can shake it off. I just wanted to get those questions that were really on my mind out of the way first, like the heavier stuff. And now, you know, it's 1998, you and your family you've just been kidnapped to Germany and, you know, you're 12 years old, and how are you dealing with, okay, first off, what village or what city do you go to?
We moved to Hannover, which is the best city in Germany to learn the language, because they're famous for having no accent or dialect at all. So
Mo, would
like,
you agree with that?
Totally.
Yeah, it's like the pure German.
Really?
It's like foreign land for me.
I didn't know that. I didn't know there was a place in Germany that had like really pure.
Yeah, I don't know what it would be, you know, in the United States. I don't know.
I don't know. I don't know. Maybe somewhere, maybe the Midwest, maybe something like Ohio or like, I don't know.
Like the real interesting places.
Super interesting places.
Yeah, Hannover is a place like that, basically, like Ohio.
I don't know.
Niedersachsen is
Hannover, it's the Ohio of Germany.
Learn the language and get out. You know?
There's the soundbite. Hanover, the Ohio of Germany. Yeah. But like, okay, so you go to Hanover, and then are you immediately jumping into school? You're also probably going through puberty or around.
Yeah,
like, so it started terrible. Right then.
Yeah, but I don't know. I think my sister had a rougher time than I had. I was kind of okay. I took everything that happened to me with neutral face and simplicity and just
like, no problem.
Go with the flow and everything like that. But you know, I was 12 years old, and I had already done the sixth grade in Iran, mm-hmm. and in order to for me to be able to keep up and to to learn the language, I repeated.
You repeated the sixth grade
here in Germany.
But you jumped right into going into school without speaking the language.
Yeah, that was kind of scary because like my parents like told me in a press conference that we're going to stay here in Germany. It was like as simple as that, and I said okay. And then like a week later, it's because we were already into the school in Germany begins earlier than in Iran.
Right.
We have 3 months of holidays in Iran in summer, here just like 6 weeks. So the school had already begun, and they said, okay, next week you're going to German school.
What the fuck?
And I knew a couple of things like Wasser
like what I know.
Like, Zahnstocher, which is toothpick. I don't know why I knew that. It was one of my first German words. But they said, okay, go to school and you'll learn. And the first year doesn't really matter because if you fail,
like the family equivalent of like throwing a baby in the water so they learn how to swim.
Yeah, it's true. It worked because when you're 12 years old, you just do it. It's like a game. You don't, especially for boys. And that's why I say it was a little harder for my sister, I guess, because I think. Girls rely much more on communication, verbal communication. Boys are like, do you play football? I said, yes, okay. And we were friends just like this,
That's really true, actually, I remember the first friend I ever made in first grade. We had also moved, but not that big of a jump. Mm-hmm. But I was a new school and I was in first grade. And I sat down at a table and this guy, Cody Coleman? No. Something like that. Oh man, that's good. Caleb Null. Caleb Null mm-hmm. was my first friend at the new school because we sat down at that table and he was like, "Hey, do you want to see the scab on my knee?" And I said, "Yeah." And then he lifted his shorts and showed this bloody knee and I was like, "Cool." We were friends from first grade until we graduated. Yeah. It's easy for boys. You're right. Yeah. Oh man, and so the language came eventually, like kind of on its own through this fresh.
Yeah, I don't remember when I, the time when I like said, okay, I now know how to speak German. It was just at the time I could speak German. But I was fortunate to have parents who did speak German and who could support me at home and mm-hmm. Try to.
They both spoke fluent German.
Yeah, because they lived here in the 70s, like for 6 years or so, and
that long.
Yeah.
Okay.
So especially my father was really behind trying to push me and to get better in German because you reach very easily like the a level of knowledge of a language where you can communicate easily and everyone understands you and you can more or less understand everything, and that's like the 90%. But for the rest 10%. You need someone to kick your ass, basically.
That's really true.
And it was my father who had himself had an accent, but he knew what was, what the sound of what is German without accent. So he tried to push me there. So he said, no, it's not really, you're not really there yet. You have to try harder. And
it's interesting that you say that, though, because I think since I've been learning. Because I didn't start learning this, trying to learn this language mm-hmm. until I was already 25. Mm-hmm. So what I've noticed too is there's There's definitely this plateau that you're talking about, around the 90%. I've seen that in a few people who are ahead of me. But I think there's even a few more plateaus. Like, there's definitely, okay, I'm comfortable now, like, going to places by myself and ordering something and maybe having, like, an interaction where someone asks me the directions. And that's enough for, like, okay, that's my plateau now. You need, like, another kick in the ass to get to, okay, I'm starting conversations with someone, or I'm, like, allowing them to not know that I speak a different language yet. And then you have this other... But it's so many levels to doing this. It's crazy. I really wish that we would have been forced to. I mean, maybe German didn't make so much sense living in New Orleans, but I don't understand why they don't put Spanish with these kindergartners, with these first graders. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I know a lot of Americans who don't speak the second language because, you know, with English you can, you know, it's fine everywhere, you know, so there's no need really. Actually, I have to think of one scene I saw in Paris like 10 years ago. I was I was there as a tourist, and I was waiting in line for a counter to buy tickets for the subway. Mm-hmm. And in front of me there were like a couple of young men from Britain, and they wanted to order, you know, to buy those tickets, and they were talking in the, I don't know where they were from Manchester or something, but they had this real. I'm not sure if you would have understood them, you know, because it was
just a super strong accent.
Yeah, super strong accent. But in their eyes, it was English, you know, the international language. And this poor woman, French woman who was sitting there at the counter, didn't understand the word. Where they were like repeating, I can't imitate it. But it was kind of ignorant to think that just because it's English, even if it was like.
But it's also the thing Germans do when foreigners don't understand them, they just speak louder.
That's true. I've experienced that. And the funny thing, I had a phase too where like my second year here, I was spending a lot of time with Germans and I was trying with German, but still way too shy.
Yeah.
And I had this thing where I was trying to communicate with Germans who didn't really speak English well at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I found I was starting to hear myself speak my own language differently. Mm-hmm. I would speak English with them, but I would maybe say it maybe a little differently.
Yeah,
and I was like, why do I have an accent all of a sudden? You know, I would hang out with like these three guys all the time. And then the next day I'd be by myself and I'd hear myself say it to a friend on the phone. And he's like, you sound weird. I was like, I do sound weird. What am I doing? God.
Yeah, but there's definitely something like international English. You know? I mean, you can set your Siri or Alexa device or whatever it is to Indian English, which a friend of mine did.
Really?
Yeah, it's so cool. You gotta try.
I love that accent.
I did it. Okay, it's probably too offending too because I'm from Iran. Maybe I'm allowed to do it.
I think you're allowed to do it. Oh man, Mo was doing it before you came in, and he's really good at it. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
No, oh, but man. You should try that. It's funny. Yeah.
Did you, you know, when you came to Germany at 12, like how long did it take before you got an interest in like the arts or filmmaking? Were you already interested in Iranian filmmaking or did that come later?
Filmmaking, not at all, to be honest. I started,
or just like films.
No, writing was my thing. I when I was like 9 or 10 years old, mm-hmm. without anyone pushing me or, you know, inspiring me or anything, I took a pen and started writing like poems or short stories just for myself. And I guess if we hadn't moved to Germany, I've probably become a writer in Persian language. But if you'd stayed
like a novelist or
probably, yeah, something like that.
That's cool.
That was like my, you know, my interest in reading and writing grew. And then we suddenly, and that's probably the tragic part, we suddenly moved to Germany and, you know, you go to school and you have to speak a language where you don't even know the word for bread, you know? So
you had it kind of taken away from you.
Yeah,
right?
And it's hard to write a poem when you don't even know the word for bread. So, you start at zero again. And so if I had any, my talent for writing or language was taken away for a couple of years. And maybe that's why I, you know, started becoming more and more interested in images and or visual storytelling, something like that.
Yeah. You had a moment like this in your acceptance speech, mm-hmm. right? You talked about how like having the language taken away maybe pushed you more towards visual mm-hmm. storytelling, right? I think that's really interesting.
Yeah.
I think it's, but when did you get into, like, were there any, were you watching any, like, American films or English films or Iranian films or anything?
Oh, yeah. I mean, American films, of course, like every film. But I'm not one of those filmmakers who can tell a story about how they find an 8mm camera in the attic and started filmmating.
No.
Very young age. I started actually making films when I was 16 or so. A good friend mm-hmm. of mine had a digital camera, and we had to do a presentation in school, and we asked our teacher if it's okay to do a short film instead of just, you know, standing in front of the class.
That's cool.
And yeah, we did something. It was called Urlaub, vacation. Like a nonsensical title, I guess, and it was about what we do in, you know, in our free time, and mm-hmm. you know, making movies became then the thing that we did for the next years to do in our free time. So that was like the spark for starting to look at films more you know, in another way, and to be more interested about, you know, the craft behind it.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, American filmmakers, especially the Coen brothers, are really important to me, because that's
They're your favorites?
Yeah, kind of. I think they're, you know, all constant inspiration. I always go back to their films and
they've been like consistently good for a really long time.
Yeah.
I think there's only two films maybe that I could forget that they mm-hmm. made. But the rest of it is just gold. Yeah. I mean, at least for me.
Yeah, it was a time when I didn't know what a director was back then.
Right,
And I know that, I zapped around TV, and, you know, that mm-hmm. was the way I watched movies. I didn't, you know, wasn't interested in particular directors or anything. So I watched whatever they showed us on TV.
Right.
And there were like three films that I really liked. And just by chance, I saw that they're all made by the same guys, Joel and Ethan Coen.
What were the three films?
One was The Hudsucker Proxy. Which is an underrated Coen film.
It is underrated. Yeah. Man, I don't even remember that one sometimes.
That was, I think, the Arte Channel showed it. And another one was Raising Arizona.
That's one of the best ones, yeah.
And I think the other one was Barton Fink or Fargo.
Really early Coen Brothers stuff. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
And then I saw, written and directed by Joel and Ethan Coen. So I guess, you know, directing is important. So it does kind of, you know, affect how the film turns out, and
right.
I became more interested in the job of a director and making movies.
So let's say that you're making these short films with your friend, and mm-hmm. you get through high school and you feel comfortable. You're totally immersed in your language. You're just a German now.
Yeah,
by that point, for sure.
Yeah.
When did coming to Munich get involved, and mm-hmm. when did you decide, you know, you want to try and apply for the HFF, the film school?
Yeah, I was I did a couple of short films during school in high school, mm-hmm. So to speak. But I wasn't sure if I really wanted to. You know, there are a couple of film schools in Germany, and I had, you know, looked up all of them. And HFF München was the only one that I was interested in to apply.
Why is that?
I don't know. I think because of that, you know, back, it was like around 2006 or so, and it was when The Life of Others came out and won the Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film. And also they had like, you know, legends and the alumni like Wim Wenders and I think Werner Herzog had some connection with the university. And,
right.
You know, Bernd Eichinger. So they had all those names, and they had, you know, for in my opinion, the perfect balance between commercial filmmaking and artistic filmmaking. So that, you know, other film universities were like either into artistic or arthouse filmmaking, or too much into commercial filmmaking.
So
But then I started actually in Hamburg. We only lived in Hannover for 3 years and moved to Hamburg. And in Hamburg, I had started studying philosophy.
And okay,
I started philosophy for 2 years and applied for the University of Film in Munich, mm-hmm. and hoped to, you know, get
accepted. So actually about HFF, how does one apply? Like, did you have to make a short film, or did you have to write something to submit to them, or
both? They have both. Like a form of questions and tasks you have to do. Like, you have to write a short exposé for a feature film, 3 or 4 pages.
Okay.
And they give you subjects, or they give you 4 subjects, and you can choose one of them to base a short film or short story about.
Okay.
And and also you have to answer questions like, who's your favorite filmmaker, and if you have
they
the
really
chance,
judge
like,
you on that.
I don't know.
Well, if it was like Steven Spielberg, like, he can't come in. Yeah, fucking Werner Herzog, we kick him out.
Yeah, yeah. Probably. I don't know. But there was this question, if you had the chance which German producer would you want to work? And I said, I don't know what the producer does. I was quite honest with
him. Yeah, I mean, at least
at that time, I did not say, that's why I'm applying for this university. I wanted to find out about what this job is. So, but it was okay for them that I didn't have it.
I think at least that's good. Yeah. It's pretty often the case, I find, at least around music schools or film schools, there's this level of, if you don't know it, then you don't belong here.
Yeah.
It's like, but I came here to educate myself.
That's true.
I came here to learn about it. It's so clicky sometimes, but that's cool. So you filled the expose and you made this little project for them. And then you said the first time they said no.
Yeah, the first time, actually, that's the first step. And then there is a second step. So they invite like 30, they accept for directing, or I think they accept somewhere around 9 students each year.
Oh, okay.
And then they have like, I don't know, hundreds of applications. And then from out of those applicants, they choose like 30 applicants and invite them to Munich, and then have workshops and group sessions with these people. And then, you like kind of a laboratory situation where you
really
look exactly how you're in a team. And then, after a couple of weeks, they let you know if you've been chosen or not. And I was invited the first time,
mm-hmm.
and they said, we've chosen 9 people, but you're in the list number 10. So if any of those applicants says, no, I don't want to, have the...
magically, one of them got sick.
Yeah.
Just coincidentally.
Yeah. I applied, but I don't want to. Actually, I changed my mind or something. Then it was
Imagine, like, with the gun to his head, he's sweating, like, I don't want to go anymore. And you're like, you motherfucking right, you don't want to go anymore.
But they said apply in next year, and if you don't mess it up, it's mm-hmm. probably going to work out. And it did.
If you don't mess it up. That's crazy, man. So how many years is the school program? How long is it, I mean?
It's designed for 4 years, but most people study more than 7, 8, 9, 10, 11.
What the fuck? Yeah,
but it's not like
that's
you,
crazy.
But it's not like you study, every day,
Most,
after 3 or 4 years, you kind of find jobs outside and try to write, sitcom pilot here or whatever.
Right.
And you wait like the big moment, which is then your diploma film to get out as your reference
your thesis card.
Your thesis card,
or whatever.
And to show off and say, okay, here I am. I'm ready to make films outside for the market.
So how long were you there?
Actually? I was there 10 years.
10 years?
Yes.
Man, I love education in Europe. Yeah. Man, it's so dreamy.
Yeah. It's I started in 2008 and I got my diploma in 2018, and I had to leave the school because I had the chance to...
they said you couldn't live there anymore.
Make my feature film.
Just imagine you with like a mattress under the stairs. Like, Ali, come on.
Yeah, but it was, it's I mean, they're trying to change it because, you know, trying to speed up a little the for everyone, especially, you know, if you're studying production, they're actually on time, so they get out of the university after 4 years. I don't know how they do it, but they're just like, they think from the beginning more economical, I guess. Yeah, directors, yeah. Directors are like, oh man, I don't know, I'm waiting, I'm still waiting for inspiration. I don't know what to write next or anything.
Well, how many projects would you say that you worked on there?
I made like officially 3 short films. The last one was not that short; it was like 45 minutes, okay. And a couple of, you know, workshop small movies or short films that, you know,
okay,
not worth mentioning really. But yeah, I started working on a sitcom pilot actually for a German television channel,
mm-hmm.
Which was not part of. Of the film school,
mm-hmm.
And then you know, I started working outside, but I still was inscribed at the school, you know, that's
right.
That's how those 10 years come together. I wasn't there like every day, but
I'm gonna imagine that you were just every single day. Hey Ali, you know, same table, yeah. Same black coffee. Classic.
Yeah. But then I had the chance to write the feature comedy, and that was my way out of the film school.
Yeah, because I mean, I was going to ask, what are the steps kind of lead? I mean, obviously, we want to talk about the goldfish a little bit, and what are the steps leading from school to getting this chance? I mean, did you already have the concept or a short or something, or how did you get in touch with, or how did it? Tell us the magic trick.
The magic trick.
Tell us the secrets.
I don't know. I guess I was at the right time at the right place.
Right. Yeah. Right place, right time. Right,
yeah. And I had my last short film, the one I told you about, which is 45 minutes, was called Behinderte Ausländer, which is hard to translate. It means
like handicapped foreigner.
Handicapped foreigners, basically. Yeah. Which is which could be a you know, said in an insulting way. But,
right. Right.
If you say it in the proper way, it's
you
not,
mentioned so that in the, it's used. Yeah. It's actually used as a joke in the Goldfish, right? Like how they pronounce the disabled people who are disabled.
That's true.
Right.
It's like the word Jew. You know, it depends who
it's coming out of and how they say it.
How to say it? Yeah. And it was a story of a young Turkish immigrant who is. sitting in a wheelchair, and you know, it had these topics about people with disability, and the producer of the Goldfish, Justina Müsch, saw that short film, and she wrote me if I'd be interested in writing just an exposé for the beginning, because you know. Mm-hmm. It wasn't clear who's going to direct it. She said, "She said you're in a no name, obviously, and you have the chance to write
it. We like this world you built.
Yeah, and she had this idea of someone taking advantage of a group of people with disability to, you know, smuggle something over the Swiss German border. That was her basic idea, and she wanted to build a story around it and ask me, and it was, you know." Exposé, 10 pages, and treatment, 20, 30 pages, first draft, 120 pages. So it started, you know, quite normal. And then I liked the script so much that she started bringing my name into the game, you know, when it came to who's going to direct this. But, you know, I did write the script not for me, not for a debut or, you know, first feature film, obviously, because they said, you know, go wild. It's going to be a big budget German comedy. You know, big budget for German.
So they already told you that pretty early on.
Yeah, she was quite honest to me. She said, she said in our first meeting, that she doesn't think that she's gonna be able to, you know, my name as a director into the game and make it able for me to direct it. And she said, if I'd still be interested.
I mean, it seems super risky, right? I mean, to use a...
No, they were still going to pay me as a screenwriter. So I said, okay.
For the writers, cool. Yeah.
so it wasn't a risk.
That's cool on its own. That's a huge step on its own.
Yeah, I said, I'd be glad to write it. And, you know, if it turns out well, then maybe next time, maybe, you know, the third.
But the goal for you was like, eventually, yeah, if this opens a door, I'd love to direct something.
I really started writing it without, you know, trying to trick them and somehow bring myself into, you know.
Like trap yourself within the story.
Yeah, I said, okay, you know, I'm fine with it and I'm not going to direct it. I'm pleased to write to the script. And it kind of opened, you know, my creativity in a way that it was more flexible in writing scenes that I hadn't written before, because when you know it's going to be your film, you know, the next film and your filmography, you take yourself a little too serious, you know. And when you're, you know, when you think you try to be more, you know,
supporting someone else's vision potentially.
Yeah.
Right.
And when, like, they say, okay,
it's a story pure.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and she said, like, I'd like to the story to end in a, you know, fun park or something, you know. It was like,
oh, she
just
told you that.
Yeah, just like an idea.
Ah, okay.
So, like, wouldn't it be nice? And I said, I don't know, you know, how I could send this group to fun, you know, they're in the middle of nowhere, but okay, I'll think about it and figure out a way how the, you know, climax of the story could take place in a fun park.
Yeah.
So it you know, you go places where you usually don't go when you write just for yourself. And it was a good experience. And after all, they liked the script so much that they trusted me with directing it. And
that's incredible. I mean, what was the news like when they said, okay, we love this and we think we would like you to direct it?
It was terrifying and
yeah,
also,
right?
Felt good at the same time, you know, because I took the script and reread it and I was like, okay.
This sucks, I gotta reread it.
Yeah. Who wrote this shit? You know? It was like, because when you don't think about, you know, it's easy to write, you know, the car crashes and turns around seven times and, you know,
yeah.
It's just, you know, can't just write it in a minute.
You're like,
but
that
then,
happens.
Yeah.
And now you're director, you're like,
then, yeah.
But what does it look like?
Yeah, and you gotta tell, you know, every department what to do and so it was kind of a, you know, challenge really. It felt like, to, for me as a director, that I had to adapt it, you know, a screenplay that someone else had written.
Well, after you found out that you were directing it, did you have, or in the process of writing it actually,
mm-hmm.
did you have other versions of the story or other, I mean, obviously you have to change things as you go along, but did you have any like major changes where you were scrapping a whole plot line or a whole character arc or something?
Oh, yes. So,
you know, you're like, this doesn't work at all. All
yeah, we had difficulties finding the main plot or the reason why he has to go to Switzerland to smuggle. Is it the right word?
Yeah.
What do you say?
I'd say he smuggles the money.
To smuggle the money.
Smuggles.
I guess
it's been enough time we can kind of spoil the story, right?
Yeah.
Okay, because I was going to ask actually, but since you're already kind of doing it, I thought, well, maybe it's actually fine. I mean, people probably haven't, it's out now, but they've had enough time.
Yeah.
I think, okay, cool. Because I wanted to talk about some of the details.
Well, let's go.
Like, no, let's not talk about the end. No, but, well, that's cool. And how long did it take for you to finish, like from concept, I mean, because
yeah.
if you had the short already, of course, but like going from concept of Oliver and like building something up here, to them saying, okay, we start shooting, you know, next week or something. How long did it take for you to finish the whole script and say this story is 100% done?
I think somewhere around 2 years or so.
Years.
Yeah, and in the meantime, I had written another script, which wasn't made or filmed, but, you know, 1 year and a half or so, I was working on the script, plus pre-production, plus shooting and editing, 2-3 years, I guess, or even more. Yeah.
I also don't really know this process from the director's standpoint, mm-hmm. but like, you know, they give you, like, Wiener Meinenberg give you the context of like how they, where it wanted to end and whatever, but were they keeping you updated with like how much budget you were able to work with, like from the very beginning, or was that something that you had to kind of fight for? Like, what was it? Was it a struggle for budget? Because I mean, movies like this, especially when it's original content,
yeah,
you know, what was that like?
No, we didn't talk that much about the budget, to be honest, which is a good sign that I had a really good producer. So
yeah.
Justina was keeping me and distance, you know, from all these, you know, technical and financial stuff. And I was, you know, sometimes they told me we gotta think of a way how to do this stunt without just with one car, because if you've seen the beginning, we have this mm-hmm. crash with the Maserati, and
yeah.
U.S. productions, Hollywood productions usually have like four or five Maseratis. If you know the first,
not on this one.
Yeah, if the you know first take doesn't work, or you know the director wants another, you know, an alternative shot or whatever.
Yeah,
and things like that. Of course, they tell you, okay, that's within our budget. We can afford only one, and things like that. But I wasn't too much involved in making decisions about you know financing and budgeting and everything.
Wait, was the car flipping the most expensive stunt in the whole thing?
As stunt, yes, it was the most expensive stunt. Yes, but okay. It was yeah. We had a couple of stunts. We had actually something that's called top drive. So you rebuild, you modify the bus in a way mm-hmm. that the stuntman is sitting on the roof and steering from the top. So that's why.
Really?
Called, yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
So the actors can sit, you know, behind the wheel in the bus
yeah.
and pretend like they're driving, but actually someone sitting up on the roof is steering the car. So that was also expensive.
That's
but,
super interesting. Yeah. I had seen that before, I think.
Yeah, they do it a lot, and it's in America, of course, because they have the budgets, but... Yeah, it's kind of a cool thing because you don't have to cut from here and there, so you can actually turn around with your camera, and you really have the feeling as an audience that they're driving. And
100%.
And
yeah,
it's really happening now because it is happening.
It's seamless. Actually.
Magically, someone's you know steering from the roof.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
Well, with films like this, with. Sometimes the story always boils down to, I mean, obviously there was a different situation here. You had some really nice companies backing it. But, you know, often with things like this, the biggest struggle would have been budget. Mm-hmm. Do you have an interesting perspective from the director and the writing standpoint as like what the biggest struggle might have been for you or for the film? Actually, like what could have slowed it down or what could have made it harder had things not worked out this way or...
Mm-hmm. I have to think about it. It's a difficult question because so many things can go wrong in your filming.
Of course,
you know,
yeah.
Like everything.
Let me try to make it clear. Yeah. Like I don't mean like you know if a cast member had an actual yeah. accident before shooting or something mm-hmm. that would just cost a lot of money or reshooting things, but like. You know, were you afraid about, spectatorship or about, were you worried that people wouldn't welcome it because of, being a new name or something?
Yeah, of course. Not because I'm a new name, because I'm not that experienced with filmmaking, especially comedy. Comedy wasn't like, I didn't consider myself as a funny guy my whole life, to be honest. So they gave me this opportunity to write a comedy. So of course you're anxious if it's going to, and you know, you can't. When it comes to laughing, you can't just say, "Oh no, they didn't understand." You know, the audience didn't understand it or anything. Either
right.
they laugh or they don't. So that's like you know, hard currency. It's like you know, you can't just say, "Okay, you didn't find it funny, but how made it feel or something."
Yeah.
You can't just talk. You know, either you laugh or you don't. So it, of course, when it came to that, we had a test screening, after a couple of months of editing, and that was the most, interesting. Or, that was my most vulnerable moment in the whole process of making this film, because suddenly okay. they had this big theater filled with 400 people I'd never seen before, and
yeah.
they come in and they just you know. They just told that they're gonna watch a comedy if they have the time, and now you show them what you've been working on for the past 3 years.
What was that like, the first screening?
Fortunately, it turned out really, really great. I mean,
how could you not like this scene with Eddie and Ollie when he says, "I don't want 300, I want 500," and he's playing with the ramp.
Yeah,
I'm serious. I had to pause it because I was watching it in a public place and I didn't want to laugh too loud. And I was like, this is so fucking good, yeah. Man. This is super funny.
I'm glad to hear it. But that, you don't know because, you know, comedy is difficult because it's
hard. It's really
it's
hard.
Really about, how, you know, what mood the audience is at the moment. You know, it can backfire at sometimes. You never know. And especially yeah. if it's your first time. But after that, they had to fill out a form and, you know, give the film notes and how, you know, from 1 to 10, how did they like it? And
it actually, was like one of the harshest ones you got.
It was all good, and it was like a dream because everyone liked it, and they had the company who does these test screenings for many major German movies. They said they had the best test results for any German movie they had tested. So that was like
holy shit!
I was so relieved. You can't imagine. This was the best day in. It was. I mean, prizes and you know, awards are nice, but that was really because it came from the audience.
That's
and it
like
was,
the real people yeah, saying like that was this
you
is know good.
You're doing the film for the audience, and they said we liked it, and it was a big relief, man.
Man, okay. The last part about the goldfish mm-hmm. that I want to get to, I have some like because I wanted to ask some general things for people that are interested in film and interested in hearing more about you. And now I want to ask a few nerdy things from me, Jordan, to you, Ali. I love the music choices, mm-hmm. the music styling. I know Carlos a little bit, but I'm a big fan of his music. Mm-hmm. And I was interested because the soundtrack reminds me so much of like The Secrets of My Success or, do you know that film from Michael J. Fox mm-hmm. or Ferris Bueller's Day Off? Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you had, if that was something that was introduced to you or if you were like, it's always going to be 80s pop.
I mean, I don't know if I'm an 80s kid. I mean, I was born in 86, but I guess growing up in Iran, I was a couple of, you know, decades always behind. So, you know, we didn't have internet and all this stuff back then. So I listened a lot to 80s music when I was a kid because my sisters were 80s kids, basically, and they were a big influence artistically on me and what they listened to.
Yeah.
So I think 80s were great. I think 80s was one of the best decades.
It fits super well. I was, you know, when the intro came on with the cool effect with the X-rays.
Yeah.
Which was really cool. And then you had this music. I was like, I didn't expect it, mm-hmm. but it really suits. Mm-hmm. Now it gives a whole tone and that's really cool. And then also, man, I don't know who I didn't check or I forgot to check who your DP was, but did you know from the beginning that you wanted this beautiful, rich saturation and this color tone? Because I think I don't see that very often in German films at all.
The DP is Matthias Fleischer, who has birthday today, actually. I caught
just got him. Matthias.
Happy birthday if you're listening to this, Matthias. And he is, he's experienced as a DP, but not he hadn't done that many comedies, mm-hmm. and it was also a challenge for him to explore new areas. And we wanted to feel the images like real movies, not too stylized, and but at the same time to have that film look. And he worked with it's called, if you want to get nerdy, it's called lookup tables, LUTs. So, and you can apply those. It's like basically like an Instagram filter.
Really?
So more or less, in a simplified way, but you can choose. And it was kind of a old Fuji stock feel that we chose.
Oh, that's interesting.
And that's why the film, it has this crisp,
contrasty,
but a little pale at the same time when it comes to skin tones and everything.
Yeah, the skin tones were a little pale, but the eye color was so rich and saturated. And the
blue was really saturated.
Blue was, the green fields and stuff. It was like, I don't see a lot of German films with this kind of color tone. So I was curious if that was something you guys knew really early on or if it was something that came later. Is that you in the grocery store scene grabbing things out of the freezer?
Yeah, that's me.
Yes! Yes!
The cameo, I was, I was kind of forced to do by Tom Schilling, but it's okay now for me. I knew it, man.
I was like, I'm so certain that's Alec. Yeah. I love the 2001 reference when in the bank scene. Very, very cool and really tasteful, actually, with the white walls and how you mm-hmm. pulled that off. I guess I don't want to sound like every fucking film interview that you've had since this film came out, but Is Kubrick an inspiration? Was that something that you did just to be funny, or was it something that you wanted to pay an homage?
Both to be honest. I mean, Kubrick is really, he's for me, you know, all filmmakers aside, and, you know, there's Kubrick on one side, because I think he's probably the, you know, greatest filmmaker who has ever lived, and maybe, you know, will, you know, he will stay unmatched in the future. I don't know about it. So, in this sense, he's not really an inspiration, because when I watch his films, it's just, okay, how the hell, you know, you can't really decode, you know, you can't really understand how he does it. You know, it's just, yeah. It's just like, you know, his films for me come from another planet or so, you know.
Yeah.
So he is, you know, I admire him, but I don't watch his films for inspiration, because I can't find any.
You watch him just for the joy of it.
Yeah, I'm just in awe when I see his films. The idea with the reference to 2001 in the you know, bank, was because we were looking for a room like this with vaults. Is it called vaults?
Or, yeah, the vault. Yeah.
The vault. And we couldn't find any. And then suddenly our location scout came up with this idea. It's a bank in Starnberg near Munich.
Okay.
And we said, okay, that's like, not I've imagined this room at all. So it's white, and they had like plants in it. And
I was going to ask if it was like a little set you made, or if it was
no,
really
no, it wasn't. So it was really, you know, we approached this whole thing, 2001 thing, one thing from the other side, because we were presented with, it was more or less our only choice. And I said, okay, this doesn't work with the concept I have in mind for this scene. Mm-hmm. But I think my DP said, he said it kind of looks like this 60 style, you know, 2001 kind of spaceship design.
Yeah, it fit really well.
Yeah, and I said, okay, let's try to enhance this, you know, and we did a couple of things, not too much with set design, and tried, you know.
It was all in the camera, man, those subtle camera turns, like the, as if the module is rotating in space. Yeah. I was like, motherfucker.
It was just like two lines in the script, but, you know, it was an inspiration, and we had a lot of fun filming that scene in this way.
And I think my last question, unless Mo thinks of something that I've forgotten to cover, but is in the world somewhere camel talk therapy a real thing, or did you make it up from scratch? I thought, man, if you made that up, how did you come up with this idea?
No, it is. Actually, in the original script, it was a... what is it called? It's not called horse therapy. It's called like the official or Latin word for horses. It's therapy with horses, basically. It was in the original script. So that's a thing. That's a huge thing, and it actually is. It works quite well, because horses can read your body language quite well, better than the therapist. So what the therapist actually do is they don't look at their patients. They look at the horses, and the way the horse reacts to their patient's body movements. Indirectly, they can read what the problem might be.
Oh my God!
So they're really good. The therapists are really good in reading.
This is
the
legit. This is like a big thing.
This is legit. Yeah, and the therapists are really good in reading the body language of the horse of the horses. And they let their horses interact with their patients, and by reading the, you know, horses, they can tell, okay, I can feel a cramp, you know, somewhere down there or something. Like, I'm not, you know, that kind
this
of an expert.
This is wild to me.
But that was in
I'm
the
gonna
original
YouTube
script.
This when I
yeah. You should. Yeah, there are a couple of interesting YouTube videos, actually, documentaries. But then we were looking for you know, a place to shoot it with, you know, some with a stable and horses, and then we came across Camels of Bavaria, which is a thing.
I thought this looks too real. It has to be a real place.
And it is like 30 minutes from Munich. So if you can go there, they have, you know, 40 camels or so. And they do sort of offer therapy, which isn't, you know, legit therapy. That, you know, it's just for people who are worked out or stressed out, and they can sit on a camel and, you know, ride around in the nature and come back and feel a little bit better, I guess. And that's the sort of therapy.
I wasn't, you know, especially like I know it makes sense when he says it's obvious why he doesn't want to ride, and then she says, "No, we can do talk therapy." And then I thought, okay, well, either he's seen this somewhere and is using it as a method to get to exposing the money, or it's or that part's made up to expose the money.
Well, the talk therapy is completely made up. This, so it's someone who talks.
That's awesome.
Who's supposed to talk to the camel? I haven't encountered so far.
I bet that's somewhere there probably. But unless you could think of something, Mo, I think there's just one little fun thing we wanted to end with. Yeah, go ahead.
We haven't talked about it yet. It's a German production, but we broadcast for an international audience.
Yeah.
How are the chances for non-German viewers to see your movie?
Yeah, book a Delta Airlines flight. Yeah. No, I'm not kidding. No, I have a couple of relatives in the States, and they're always asking me, "Could you send us a link or a DVD?" Unfortunately, the German DVD and Blu-ray don't have English subtitles.
That is something I've noticed that's really hard for. I don't know why that's something that they don't think about with German streaming or with German films, but that's a huge untapped market, man. Yeah. There's so many things I would love to watch.
You're probably the only foreigner that's interested.
Yeah, but actually, the funny thing is a really nice lady from New York wrote me a couple of weeks ago that she was sitting in a Delta Airlines flight, that's why I know, and she by accident clicked on the Goldfish because she was curious, and she told me a similar story that she had to pause, not to laugh out loud to annoy her seat neighbors, which which was nice to hear, but she asked me if I'd be interested to, show the film in New York or something. So I if she's listening to it right now, I don't know.
I hope so.
Yeah. I sent her a link and she said, let's give it a try. Maybe she'll find someone who could.
And you guys have been married ever since.
Yeah.
No, but that's a great question. Yeah, so we don't know exactly when, but hopefully.
I'll let you know if there's any chance soon. If it's on I don't know, Amazon Prime US or something. As far as I know, it's only available. I mean, it's in Germany, and you can watch it on iTunes or Amazon Prime or DVD or Blu-ray. But in America or other countries, I don't know. Unfortunately.
Okay. Yeah. So final thing is just a little game. I'm going to ask you three film-related questions.
Oh, yeah.
I want you to think from the gut, from the hip. There's no wrong answer.
Okay.
And here we go. So if you could have written any famous film, any time that it was ever created, what film would you have wished you would have written?
Sullivan's Travels by Preston Sturges. I don't know if you've
that's
if
you know a that. Super cool. I wouldn't have guessed that at all.
No, that's like my favorite old school dialogue. The dialogue is just amazing, this film.
That's awesome. If you could be any Coen Brothers character from any film, who would it be?
Oh, that's hard. They don't they suffer a lot, so
that's true.
I don't know if I want to.
Maybe someone from Hail Caesar. I don't know. They suffer so less.
I told Jordan before, the only one I would want to be would be the cat from Inside Llewyn Davis.
That's cheating.
I'd probably be the husband of Francis McDormand in Fargo, who does the paintings for post stamps. You know,
because
this guy is like he has a happy ending and nothing to worry about.
He's got such an easy breezy life, man. Yeah,
probably him.
And final one, what was your favorite film from the 2020 Oscar nominations?
I mean, it's a bit obvious, but Parasite, definitely.
Totally agree. Yeah, I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah, Parasite was just...
It's like painfully good.
Yeah.
It's like...
Did
you see Snowpiercer as well?
Yeah, I've seen all films of Bong Joon-ho. And Mother is, I don't know if she's seen Mother, it's my favorite, second favorite after Parasite.
No, I didn't see Mother.
Yeah, he also made that in Korea, so with Korean actors, and it's a great...
But this isn't connected to the Darren Aronofsky Mother.
No, it's a completely different story.
Okay. But, Well, cool, man. Then would you want to? No, we don't. There's another mini game that we try sometimes, but I think this is good. This is just yours, just designed for you. So
thanks.
It's been an absolute pleasure to have you. Really, from my heart, thank you for spending time with us and opening up about everything. And go see The Goldfish. It's available everywhere for streaming. And thanks a lot, man.
Thank you very much.
Artsy Fartsy Immigrants, ein Podcast von John Prinz und Moritz Batscheider, produziert für M94.5.